Before I introduce our speaker, let me welcome two special guests who are in our audience. Faith McClintock, who is the Director of Economic Development for Albemarle County, if you would just acknowledge. And Steve Allshouse, who has a long title which shortens to Chief Economist for Albemarle County. Last, and I believe some of them have staff with them, so here's hoping we have a great discussion. Last year, a senior statesman of Virginia presented a thought-provoking panel discussion, pros and cons of growth in Charlottesville. Today, we are looking into growth from the perspective of our local economy versus the rest of the U.S. Dr. Ann Battle-Maharis, Vice President of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, is well positioned to discuss the Charlottesville economy and the national economy. Dr. Maharis oversees two functions within the Richmond Bank's research department, regional research and economic education. In addition, her research interests include regional industry specialization and determinants of growth at the regional level. Dr. Maharis joined the Richmond Bank as vice president of the research department in February 2009. Before that, she served as senior economist for the Virginia Economic Development Partnership and has a background in banking, consulting, and economics as well. Dr. Maharis has her PhD in economics from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and an undergraduate degree from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. So on that note, please join me in welcoming Dr. Maharis.
Thank you, Nancy. So I am going to assume that some of you are very familiar with the Fed, and some of you are not. So, and that some of you look at economic statistics or economic trends all the time, and maybe some of you don't. So I'll try to provide some explanations so that we can all be on the same page. And this is my plan for this afternoon. I'm going to give you a little bit of background on the Richmond Fed and the Federal Reserve System, and then transition to talking about the regional economy, and then talk about the national economy and monetary policy. That's quite a lot to cover. So I will do my best to keep us on track. Please, and these are like disparate topics here a little bit, so just, you know, keep track of those questions for the end, and I'll take any questions then. So I'm really pleased to be here with this group. I've heard a lot about the high level of engagement with this group, so I hope you will definitely have some good conversation, good discussion when we conclude. So we'll start with the Federal Reserve system and how we're structured. We're a decentralized central bank, which may sound kind of funny, but we are a decentralized central bank. The centralized piece of it is the Board of Governors, which is located in Washington, D.C., and the decentralized piece, and sometimes we refer to them as sort of decentralized and even nonprofit component of it, is the 12 Federal Reserve District banks. I'll come back to the profit piece because it's not true that the Federal Reserve doesn't generate any funds, but that profit goes back to the government. So in that sense, we're a nonprofit in those reserve banks. So the Board of Governors is in Washington, D.C., and there are seven members. They are called governors, and they are appointed by the president, or nominated, I guess I should say, by the president, and then appointed by the Senate. They have to be confirmed. So there's that government component of oversight in terms of who it serves as a governor, and they serve 14-year terms, staggered terms. So one president isn't going to influence the whole Board of Governors. So there's that balance there as well. So the Board of Governors has oversight for the Federal Reserve System, and they administer the banking regulations. Those come out of the Board of Governors, the board staff. They have staff that analyze economic conditions. All the different reserve banks also have that. and they participate on the Federal Open Market Committee. So that's that box you see below. And the Federal Open Market Committee is the group that carries out monetary policy, makes those monetary policy decisions. So you may know that in December, the Fed raised the federal funds rate target, and we had been at nearly zero for a long time, and now we're just a little bit higher than that. So it was a very long time with practically zero interest rates, so there was a lot of anticipation and publicity around that. So that's the decision of the Federal Open Market Committee. Those seven governors from the board serve on that committee, and then five of the Reserve Bank presidents. All of them participate in the meetings, all of them provide input, but when it comes to voting, it's the seven governors and five Reserve Bank presidents. The New York Fed president is always a voting member, but the others rotate. And my president, Jeff Lacker at the Richmond Fed, he was voting last year, and now he has rolled off as a voting member. So he's a voting member every 3 years. So, and last year was that year for him. So the Reserve Banks really carry out the day-to-day operations. There are a lot of day-to-day operations with a Reserve Bank. You can imagine the processing of payments, which I'll talk about in a minute, but the processing of electronic payments involves a heavy use of technology. We have a lot of IT workers at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond and at the other reserve banks as well, but we have a lot in Richmond. We have a lot of bank examiners. That's the day-to-day operations of a reserve bank. And we process cash. We don't print cash. So people, over the years, I've heard people talk about those printing presses at the Fed, but we don't. We do have a lot of cash coming in and out, though, and what we do with it is process it through very high-tech machinery that takes out dirty, torn-up currency, not fit for circulation, and we shred that, and we also look for counterfeits. So it's very sophisticated technology, processes a lot of bills in seconds, a lot of bills, and if we find counterfeits, the Secret Service, that gets turned over to the Secret Service and they deal with that, and we do find them. But so those are some of the day-to-day operations of the banks. And then, of course, each of those presidents serves on the Federal Open Market Committee. So that's kind of the broad overview. And this just shows you the 12 districts. It's kind of interesting because the Fed was established by the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. This was following a period where we saw in the early 1900s and late 1800s a lot of banking panics, runs on banks. So you might think that that's the reason that the Federal Reserve was established, and it is one of the reasons, but there was also a big need at the time because there were different currencies circulating, and there was a need to have a system where the money supply could expand when needed. So at the time, we had a much more agrarian-based economy, and there were times of year when more money was spent, more cash exchanged hands, and the money supply wasn't able to expand with that need. So a more elastic currency is the way it's referred to. That was a primary reason for the establishment of the Federal Reserve. But don't have time to go into the whole history of it here, but just to say the map reflects this 1913 establishment. So you see the a lot of districts concentrated in the east, huge 12th district, the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. I'm jealous of them. They get to go to Alaska and Hawaii in their district. So, but a very large district, and you can see just, the further west you go, the larger they are. And the other thing to note before, in talking about the way the Federal Reserve is structured is that we do have some independence from government. You could see that a little bit in the centralized Board of Governors, the independent Federal Reserve banks. And the Fed was intentionally structured to have some independence from government, particularly in the monetary policy arena, so that monetary policy decisions would be made without being driven by short-term political interests, but rather be based on what's best longer-term for the economy. So we have accountability. We do get audited, but we do have that independence, particularly in the monetary policy. And I mentioned that thinking of those reserve banks as nonprofits, the Fed does make money. We earn interest on our holdings of securities. I'll show that at the end. We hold a lot of securities. And so after paying all the operating expenses of the Fed, what's left over is turned over to the Treasury. And in 2014, excuse me, that was $96.9 billion that was turned over to the U.S. Treasury. So that's just an example. So our district, the 5th district you see there in purple, includes Virginia, of course, Maryland and D.C., West Virginia, and North and South Carolina. Quite a diverse district, actually. And I was talking about this at lunch. Altogether, we are pretty representative of the national economy in the way that the 5th district economy moves. Of course, nobody really cares about that particular grouping. You know, 5th district is of interest to my president as he goes and reports out on the regional economy to the Federal Open Market Committee. You know, you may not really care that much about North and South Carolina, but these economies kind of, and their composition very different and kind of balances out and looks a lot like the nation, which I think is kind of interesting for us and for our president when he's reporting out on it. But so we're kind of that mid-Atlantic chunk of the country. And you see that labeled 5E, which is just an aside, you know, that it's alphabetical and numerical. So our district is 5E. And you might notice that some of our publications, I think, might play on that word. So there's this regional component to the system. And I'm actually in the research department. And as Nancy said, I head up our regional research area as well as economic education. And we spend a lot of time tracking the regional economy. And we do that with the data that we can get our hands on. We run our own surveys, monthly surveys of manufacturing and services. And we also collect anecdotal information. So if you have ever heard of the Beige Book, which comes out 8 times a year before the FOMC meeting, the Beige Book, each of the reserve banks works on their section of the Beige Book, and that comes out of my area. And we make phone calls, we send emails, we look at our survey comments. We have industry roundtables that we get together with. We have one in Richmond, Charlotte, Baltimore, Charleston, West Virginia, Charleston, South Carolina. And we meet with businesses and just hear their take on what's going on in the economy. So we have different ways of getting on-the-ground information and the published data, and we try to combine that all to give the best possible, you know, accurate picture we can of what's going on in the regional economy. And here I just wanted to give a little bit of an overview of our core functions. I mentioned a few of them already in passing. Monetary policy is probably the one that is most familiar to people because of the attention we get on our interest rate, I don't want to say setting, targeting function. We target a short-term interest rate, the federal funds rate, and that influences a lot of interest rates, shorter-term interest rates in the economy, so that definitely gets a lot of attention. So the monetary policy piece is probably what's most familiar. The supervision, we have, I should know this better, but that's probably our largest department at the Richmond Fed, is our supervision and regulation area, because we have a couple of large banks in our district, and we also have a lot of smaller banks in our district. So we have examiners that maybe spend all their time at Bank of America, and we have examiners that focus more on small banks and travel a lot. So that's an important function. And I mentioned payment services. as well. So we process electronic payments. As you might imagine, people don't write checks as often as they used to. My husband still writes checks. He still pays all the bills by check. I don't, though. So, and even if you do write checks, they're processed differently than they used to be. And that's really important. And so the Federal Reserve System had to adjust to that. In fact, when I came in 2009, we were shutting down our check processing operations in Charlotte and in Baltimore because we went from, I think it was 45 different locations, check clearing sites, check processing sites in 2003, 45, down to one now, and it's in Atlanta. So, yeah, we used to have planes that flew checks around. So it's, you know, we had to adjust to that. So so that's part, that would come under payment services or electronic processing. We do some interesting things like processing the payments for, it's not called food stamps now, but if I say food stamps, you know what I mean. We have a role in that. So you wouldn't expect that to be something that the Federal Reserve does, but on the back end, we help process those payments. You might think of bank supervision and regulation and these payment services as kind of being one, you know, both part of one important role in stability of the financial system. We found at the Richmond Fed that people kind of maybe bring those two things together and then think of monetary policy as another role. And the other thing we do, as I mentioned, we're out in the community a lot. I have economists doing that. We also have a community development area that, for example, during the mortgage foreclosure crisis, they convened service payments. What's the right word? Some of the mortgage service providers and people who were trying to get modifications to their mortgages. There were sizable events where people could come and try to get information and get their mortgage modified. And so that's just an example of our community development area does some convening of partners and sharing of information. So so we're also out in the community quite a bit. So that's kind of the overview of the Richmond Fed. I know it's kind of short, but follow up with me if you have specific questions, or go to our website, too. We have quite a bit of good information on our website. But I'm going to transition now and talk about the regional economy. And I'm going to start really by comparing Virginia and the Charlottesville region, and looking a little bit across the state as well. So I assume some of you are from other parts of the state in this room. Some of you are probably from out of state as well. So give you a little bit of comparison. So we're going to start with Virginia. And my charts, just to explain it a little bit, because you'll see some repetition in the look. And you see a gray shaded area there. I don't know how well it comes across, but if you see the gray shaded area is the area of recession. So the recession lasted from December 2007 until June of 2009. And that shaded area just kind of points out that time period so you can see how these various indicators trended going in and out of and during the recession. So here, this is employment growth, comparing Virginia and the U.S. And a convenient way to compare two areas of very different size is to look at the percentage change year over year. So that's what we're showing here, employment growth year over year trend. So as of December, so that number in December, year over year growth from December 2014 to December 2015 was 1.5% in Virginia, 1.9% in the U.S. And the lighter blue line is Virginia. And a couple things to point out. If this series went back before 2006, you would see employment growth in Virginia faster than employment growth in the U.S. pretty consistently. Coming into the recession, we were about even with the U.S. Employment didn't contract as much in Virginia as it did in the U.S. during the recession. It contracted, for sure, but not as much. And then coming out in those first years of the recovery, Virginia did better. And, you know, growth was faster than than the U.S. until about mid-2011. And then you see those lines cross, and Virginia starts to underperform. And so what was going on there was the Budget Control Act, a lot of discussion and then action about what was going on with federal government spending. So the Budget Control Act and then sequestration really decreased federal government spending. And Virginia has a very high share of we're one of the top states for federal government contracting. So when that is pulled back, that has quite an effect. So there were, you know, there could be other things going on at the same time, but I can point out that factor as being really important. And you can see we even in early 2014 had a little bit of contraction in employment. We started having real budget problems in the state because of that, and because it affected our state revenues, of course. But then since then, the good news is that employment growth has been catching up, coming, you know, inching closer to being back on par with U.S. growth. So I'm pretty optimistic seeing that trend. And we'll look at some industry-level data, too, to kind of reinforce that optimistic view. So anyway, so that is the good news. Virginia is catching up. If we look across the state at the MSA level, Metropolitan Statistical Area, these are the major metropolitan statistical areas in the state. And some of our smallest metro areas, Winchester, Blacksburg, are growing the fastest, 2.5%, 2.3%, above the national average. Northern Virginia at 1.9%. You know, often looking back over time, you'd see Northern Virginia as the fastest growing metro area of the state. But I'll tell you, looking at this chart, the same chart over the past couple of years, Northern Virginia has been not at the bottom, but well below the state and national average. So this is helping because Northern Virginia is so big. This is really helping the overall state employment numbers to look better. So Northern Virginia being back up there in the top three is pretty significant. But we still have some sizable metro areas, Virginia Beach, Richmond, that have somewhat softer growth. And Charlottesville, kind of middling, little under 1%, little just over 0.5% growth. What I might say about Charlottesville and Roanoke and Lynchburg, for that matter, is that smaller metro areas, you might see, you know, more fluctuation moving up and down in the ranking there when you look at any particular year-over-year data point. So sometimes I like to look at kind of a three-month trend in looking at metro area growth. But this is what it looks like in the most recent data point. Again, that's year-over-year growth. It's like taking that endpoint. It's like taking the endpoint off of this chart and just looking across metro areas. That's how they compare. And now I'm going to backtrack a little bit and look at the time series again. Year over year growth in employment. Now we're putting Charlottesville in the mix. And I mentioned more volatility in a metro area. You can see that in this chart. Charlottesville is the green line. And I think some important observations here, as I mentioned in the previous graph, well, coming into the recession, Virginia and the U.S. economy were trending pretty similarly, but Charlottesville was doing great, right? And employment growth in Charlottesville was much higher than in the U.S. or in the state as a whole. The recession hit, didn't contract quite as much, and then came out of the recession, and Charlottesville was performing pretty much on par with the state and with the U.S., and these most recent numbers here look kind of funny, and I'll explain it a little more in the next chart where you can see it better, but for now, I'll just say if you were to just smooth through those, that spike, that trough and that spike there, where something a little funny was going on in the numbers, we've had some consistent growth until really maybe the past several months where it has slowed down, still growing, but at a slower pace. So this is the trend we see for Charlottesville. And another way to look at it, and also compare these areas of very different size is to, instead of looking at percentage change year over year, look at the level, but index it to a particular point in time. So here we're looking at the employment trend, the trend in the level of employment, but indexing each of those series to December of 2007. So that takes on a value of 100. And then any movement we see is what that series was doing. When it gets back to 100, it's reached the level it had been in December of 2007. And going above 100 means, you can think of it as, we've recovered those jobs that were lost, and moving up above 100, we're adding more jobs than we had in December of 2007. So you can see for Virginia and for the U.S., it was early to mid-2013, actually, when we had more than recovered the jobs lost during the recession. And for Charlottesville, really just shot up, had some pretty strong growth in employment, and then it sort of flattened off a little bit. And there's this weird spike. The pointer doesn't work, but you can see there's like this downward drop there. I wish I could tell you exactly what that was. I'm not really sure. So it's kind of odd, but it made this graph look, it caused that jumpiness. And again, if you smooth through that, we had a pretty strong upward trend in employment. Someone else in the room might know what that number is. No, you're shaking your head. Okay. So sometimes we just can't figure out. Sometimes it's just a data glitch. So, but that's what the trend has looked like. So Charlottesville doing pretty well. And again, you know, when you think about, okay, so growth has slowed, but we had some strong growth taking us to, in Charlottesville, taking us to a level that, you know, we're relative to when the recession hit, Charlottesville is doing pretty well. Okay, and this is looking at some different data, because at the county and city level, we don't have the same monthly series of data that we get at the metro level or state level. It's actually better data. The quality of the data is better because it's not a survey. This data is survey-based that I've been showing you. This data here that you see on the map comes from the unemployment insurance paperwork that firms have to file with the state. So it's much more comprehensive. It's not a survey. Everybody has to file that paperwork, just about everybody. There are a few exemptions, including railroads, but it covers like 99% of employers. And so the most recent data, it lags a little bit. We have second quarter of 2015, so through June. And so this is just showing employment growth from June to June, 2014 to 2015, across the state. And you can see that we have, so the darker blue are the higher areas of growth, and darker blue and lighter blue shading. And that's concentrated in central Virginia, as well as portions of the valley. And you can see Charlottesville there as well is blue, showing that employment growth. And the red, most concentrated in southwestern Virginia. That's the area of strongest contraction. Some contraction also in the yellow areas that look kind of greenish here, but there's a lighter greenish that's really yellow. And green is kind of right in the middle with some modest growth. And so that's kind of how a lot of variation in economic performance across the state. So coming back to Charlottesville, what does Charlottesville look like by major industry sector? This is, again, back to that monthly data, survey-based data. And here we see, just kind of comparing Charlottesville against Virginia in terms of these major industry sectors and where employment is concentrated. And a couple of things I think pop out to me is that, you know, some of the sectors do not differ all that much. So that natural resources, mining and construction, which is mainly construction, really, in Charlottesville, pretty similar in concentration, close to 5%, similar to the U.S., to Virginia. Also similar in financial activities and in information. Information is, think of published Word, not like IT, you know, information technology information, but think of publishing. That's a small sector in the state and in Charlottesville. Government sector is much larger. And this, you know, of course, this is UVA, so it's really education and health services. In fact, if we were to move the employment that's associated with UVA, you know, we'd see a much higher concentration in educational and health services for Charlottesville compared to the state, and government probably being about the same as most other metro areas, where local government is the biggest piece. So in the Charlottesville area, state government represented in the university is very large. So that's a difference. Professional and business services is a smaller share, at close to 13%. Not too different from some metro areas in the state, but overall, 18% is what we have for statewide concentration in professional and business services. So that's what it looks like. That's where our employment is concentrated. And here I want to see, well, what has grown? Those same major industry sectors, where have we seen the most growth in Charlottesville? And how does that compare to those same sectors growing in Virginia? So we have the total, you know, total growth, 1.5% for the state versus 0.7% for Charlottesville. And the good news is that government sector, which is so big, right, made up 32.5% of employment, grew at 2.2%. So we had strong growth. I guess that a lot of growth in the university and the health, probably, I'm guessing, probably in the health system component of it, maybe even more than the other components. So that is good news. That sector, you know, had a small contraction in the rest of that in the rest of the state, where local government was kind of cutting back. The bad news here, though, is that professional and business services, which even though it was not as large a share of employment as we have as it is for the state, it was still sizable. It was still over 12% of employment. We had contraction there of 4.2%. So that sector contracted. For the state, we had strong growth, 3.7%. And we're starting to get back up to where that sector is growing nationally and in the state. So 3.7% is pretty good. And that helps bring those numbers up. Financial activities grew more strongly in Charlottesville than they did in the state as a whole. So those are some of the industry sectors. I'd like to kind of show where the employment is concentrated, and then you see, you know, how important is growth in some of those various sectors. So something that's not that important, really, manufacturing. Declining 2.6%. In the whole scheme of things, that's not a very large sector for Charlottesville. So, you know, it's more important that the professional and business services sector is off versus that manufacturing sector. Okay, so that is all about job growth, what we've talked about so far. And we focus a lot on employment because that's the data that's most readily available for us at the state and metro level. But other measures that we look at for how is the labor market doing, unemployment, that kind of brings together both sides of the equation, not just how much demand we have for labor on the part of businesses, but also how many people are out there looking for work. So it brings both sides of the equation together. And here we have the trend in the unemployment rate for the U.S., for Virginia, and for Charlottesville. And Charlottesville unemployment consistently runs below the rate of unemployment for the state, which is pretty low, lower than the U.S. So most recently, it's down to 3.7%. And the unemployment rate is the ratio of the number of people who are unemployed. It's also a survey, so it surveys households. And people are asked very simple questions. Are you working or are you not working? And if you're not working, you're asked more questions. You're asked about whether you are searching for work. So you have to be searching for work in order to be considered part of the labor force if you're unemployed. And so so that's where we get this ratio. Now, I double-checked this chart this morning because this is metro area unemployment, and Danville is the highest at 5.2%, but that's pretty low for Danville, so and it's right. So that caught my eye. I thought, is that number right? Yes, it is. So remember here that the state number was 4.2%, and consistently Charlottesville, and you saw that in the time series, but consistently Charlottesville and Northern Virginia are going to run below the U.S., below the Virginia and the U.S. rate of unemployment. And you see that here. Roanoke is also below, as is Winchester. So we have a number of metro areas with an unemployment rate lower than the statewide rate. And where we have higher rates, those numbers have been coming down as well. So Danville, Lynchburg, Virginia Beach, MSA, those numbers have been ticking downward. And here I have a similar to what I showed you before, just so you can see the variation in unemployment rates across the state by county. We also get these numbers monthly by county and city. So the darkest blue areas of Southside Virginia and Southwestern Virginia tend to have the highest unemployment rates, pockets of it elsewhere, and that, you know, Central Virginia up to the Northern Virginia and the Northern Shenandoah Valley, always low unemployment rates there. So you can see that variation. Now, turning a little bit away from labor markets and looking at what's going on in the housing market in Charlottesville. So we're going to wrap up these regional trends, showing you first what's happened to home prices. This is a home price index that we get from CoreLogic Information Systems. It's pretty comprehensive. And so the trend, this is a year-over-year change in home prices. And you can see that for Charlottesville, home prices didn't fall as much during the recession as they did in Virginia or the U.S. And more recently, that trend is pretty much right in line with the state. So Virginia, 1.7% growth in home prices year over year, and 1.6% in the Charlotte MSA. That is slower than the national rate by a fair amount. In the U.S., it's 6.2%. I showed you, you know, what the 5th District looks like. North and South Carolina in particular, over 7% year-over-year growth in home prices. So, you know, there are areas of the country where home prices are growing a little faster right now. But they are continuing to grow. So we still have a decent, relatively strong housing market. And here we see on the construction side, an indicator we can look at is permits. That's sort of that early phase of construction. And this is showing year-over-year percent change can be very volatile, which you can see for Charlottesville. So we look at the three-month average and take the year-over-year change in that. It smooths things just a little bit. And the numbers we get for the U.S., 10.7% growth year-over-year in permits. For the state, that's 15%. And for Charlottesville, it's negative 12.8% right now. But you can see the volatility in that series that could, I guess I wouldn't read too much into that being a negative number right at this point. You could almost look across and say, well, it might be kind of flatter in Charlottesville than it is in the state more recently. So that's building permits and just a little bit on housing. So now I want to switch gears, and I'm scoping further out to the national economy, where we have more of a variety of information that we can track. And the broadest measure is real gross domestic product, U.S. real GDP. And I'm including here the staff projections. When staff here means it's called actually the Summary of Economic Projections that is published four times a year by the Federal Open Market Committee participants. So each of them submit their projections. Those little bars out there are the projections going to the end of 2016, 2017, 2018. And you can see that they're right around 2%. So moderate growth in real GDP is what the staff, the presidents and governors are expecting. But what happened recently? Well, we got the first estimate of fourth quarter real GDP for 2015. We get another couple of estimates of this number as more data comes out. And it can change. It can even change from negative to positive. Especially if it's, or positive to negative, I guess I should say, you know, especially when it's not that far away from zero. So, you know, 0.7%. In the third quarter, it was 2%. And you can see we've had, you know, the occasional quarter where growth had softened. That's what happened this time. And the reason that growth was softer was because inventory accumulation declined. So businesses weren't stocking up as much as they had. We heard that also anecdotally from some of our contacts that transportation, that freight was slow. So, you know, that goes hand in hand with firms just not wanting to stock up as much as they had before. That tends to play itself out. So that is unlikely to be a factor when we get to the next quarter of GDP, but we'll have to wait and see. So that took some growth off of that GDP number. Real personal consumption expenditure, so you know what you spend on goods and services, that makes up about 70%, that household spending, 70% of real GDP. It's a really important number. And that was a little softer this time as well in the fourth quarter, 2.2%. It wasn't really, I mean, that's right in line with where consumption had been growing for quite a while in the recovery, but we had bumped up to better than 3% growth in consumption. So, you know, that made it a softer pace of growth in real GDP. And then another component was business investment. Business investment in structures and business investment in equipment were both softer in the fourth quarter. And then also net exports. So a couple of things affect our exports. And one of those is the strength of the dollar. So if you talk to businesses that do a lot of exporting, you know, they are facing competition from, you know, other countries where it's less expensive for countries to get goods and services, you know, relative to the U.S. because of the strength of the dollar. So that hurts our exporters. It's great for you, right, if you're traveling to other countries. It's very helpful. And it also allows us to import more. But that works in the wrong direction for real GDP. As imports go up, that takes real GDP growth down. So we had a negative component there in net exports because of exports falling off and imports growing. So both of those things happened. And here are some of the individual components so you can see from third quarter to fourth quarter. The third quarter is the darker blue, and the fourth quarter, that most recent number, is the lighter blue. So you see the overall number on the left, real GDP. PCE is that personal consumption expenditure number I mentioned. It was 3%, went down to 2.2%. Residential investment, that's housing. And that's been strong. 8.2% stayed strong at 8%, and a lot of analysts expect that to get even stronger over the course of the year. And the business side, non-residential means the business side. So there you see the structures and equipment. Equipment is notable because we have been growing 9.9% in the third quarter, so businesses aren't purchasing as much equipment. That takes away from GDP. On the investment side, one thing I wanted to comment about that is that, you know, the energy sector has been hit pretty hard. With low oil prices, there's not as much drilling. And that drilling equipment, the rigs, that comes under investment structures. So some of what might sound more like equipment when you read about it is actually a structure in these statistics. And that was one of the reasons why we've had these declines in several quarters in structures, because other business investment in structures has actually been pretty decent. So, you know, in industrial type buildings, for example, has been relatively strong and even in offices. Retail, not so much, but you know, in other structures, non-residential, we've had some growth, but not on the energy sector side, and we're seeing that in some of the numbers. So we have some other information flow that we look at, and I've just picked a few that tend to get a lot of a focus. This is the Purchasing Managers Index that is produced by the Institute of Supply Managers. There are some manufacturers that I've talked to that say that, you know, they track very closely to this manufacturing. It's the darker blue one that's the manufacturing index, and the lighter blue one is a non-manufacturing index. So I've had some companies say they track very closely with that manufacturing index. So it gets a lot of attention. It's a very simple index. It's survey-based, and businesses are asked very simply, was your production up, down, or did it stay the same? And the percent increase minus the percent that say decrease, that gives us a diffusion index. And when it's 50, then it's about even with the number of people saying increase and the number of people saying decrease. If it's above 50, then we generally look at that as expansion. And if it's below 50, we generally look at that as a contraction going on in the economy. So that's why you see that line across at 50. And so what's happened here is that for manufacturing, it's been slipping below 50, that dark blue line. It's been below 50 now for four consecutive months, and it's currently at 48.2. So it went up a teeny bit from December to January, but January is the most recent number. And so there are a lot of questions. These businesses are asked about production, about new orders, about employment, about their exports, about their capacity utilization. A couple of those, and then there's a composite that's put together, and that's the trend you're seeing here. But a couple of the components, production and new orders, had gone back up above 50. So, you know, the manufacturing sector has been suffering for sure, and part of that is dollar appreciation, sluggish growth, demand from overseas with some other areas of the world growing more slowly than the U.S. But so there's, you know, the fact that those components are increasing is somewhat hopeful that we'll see an upward trend. The Richmond Fed does a monthly survey of manufacturing and of services that we compare against these numbers. Often I'll show that graph. Our manufacturing index has been slightly positive and just kind of, you know, in this narrow range around zero. So it's been a little flatter than this ISM number. On the non-manufacturing side, that lighter blue line, it has been well above 50, but it has come down a little bit. So it's at 53.5 right now, and it was at 55.8 in December. And it's been coming down, but again, well above 50, which means that we generally still see expansion in the non-manufacturing sector more so than manufacturing. And non-manufacturing is a much larger share of our economy, certainly a much larger share of our employment, but a larger share of our economy overall. So on the consumer side, a monthly series that we get, again, you know, real GDP comes out quarterly. There's some lag there. There are different estimates that kind of change that number before we get a final number. So we like to have monthly numbers that we can look at to get some sense of where is consumer spending going. Right now, that data is only through December, but we'll have a January number, we'll have a February number. You know, we'll get some additional monthly information well before we get first quarter real GDP. So it can be interesting to look at this. And I'm showing the percent year-over-year growth in two pieces of this, real personal consumption expenditure and real personal income. The real personal consumption expenditure, 2.6% growth year over year. And so that's maintaining a fairly decent rate of growth. The notable story here is that real personal income grew 3.6%. And you can see that light blue, that upward trend. Well, maybe the last couple of months coming down a little bit, but we're staying at this well above 3% rate. Just to explain, there are a couple of, you see a spike and then a trough there, and that was because consumers respond to policy changes. We had so I guess that was the end of 2013 going into 2014. We had some changes in our tax code, and people were pulling forward some of their income. And so we got this like lumpiness that came into the statistics from people pulling income forward so they wouldn't get taxed on it. And then, you know, you see a year later, that looks like a big drop off. So that's what was happening there. So ignore that part of the graph. So look at the more recent trends where we've been maintaining decent growth in consumption and that personal income piece. It's real personal income, which means it's adjusted for inflation. And what that inflation adjustment has done recently is because of the fall in energy prices, we all see it at the gas pump. We're paying a lot less for energy. So in real terms, our income is going further. And that's what you're seeing there as well. That's why you're seeing that kind of buoys our real personal income. So turning to the housing market nationally, this is showing two measures, both construction related. This isn't year over year growth. This is just the level of permits and the level of housing starts for single family homes. And what's important to note here is that we've got this gradual improvement. It has been sustained now for several years, growth in construction, and it's not booming growth, right? It's been just this very modest pace, but it's been sustained. And those dotted lines are showing the average that we had in the 1990s. So for starts, it was 1.1 million. For permits, it was right around a million. Those dotted lines are showing you really, you can see how far below that we still are. So it's going to take us a while to get back to where we were in the 1990s, unless we start to see some sharp pickup. But, you know, at this rate that we've been going, it's going to take a while. So we're even ignoring the boom period, right? We're not looking at getting back to, 2005, 2006. That line is just showing that we're still well below the 90s. So I think that's interesting. While we're improving, sometimes it's important to go back and look at, yes, but where, you know, where are we relative to history? So looking at labor markets then for the U.S., we've already seen labor, you know, employment growth for Virginia, for Charlottesville, for our metro areas, for our counties for that matter. Employment growth nationally has been one of the stronger points recently in our growth picture. And we've had sustained growth in jobs. Now for January, we had 151,000 jobs added. That was following 280,000 in November, 262,000 in December. We had an average monthly gain during 2015 of 228,000 jobs. That's a very good pace of job growth. And the gains that we saw with this most recent number were very broad-based. In fact, we had an increase in manufacturing jobs that we hadn't seen for a couple of years, the largest monthly increase in manufacturing jobs. And you can just see the trend there, that we've maintained a pretty steady pace of job growth. Sometimes people ask, and maybe I should just let you ask it, but sometimes people ask me if it includes part-time jobs, and it does. So some of those jobs are part-time jobs. Some of them are full-time jobs, but it's counted as a job, as a net gain. I already talked a little bit about the unemployment rate, and we actually saw the trend nationally. And here what we're adding is the projection from the Board of Governors and the Reserve Bank presidents. That's those little boxes out there is where they project the unemployment rate to be. And that's the central tendency around their estimates. There's a range in their estimates. But if we look out to the end of 2016, 17, 18, you know, we're expecting, when I say we, the Federal Open Market Committee participants are expecting that the unemployment rate is going to kind of level off. So it's at 4.9% more, right now, and the expectation is that it's not going to decline much more. So other measures that we look, and I don't have charts included here, but other things we pay attention to in this jobs report that comes out first Friday of every month, other things we pay attention to are the labor force participation rate. So that has been at historic lows. It increased a little bit. It's now at 62.7%. So it went from 62.6 to 62.7. But it's been low, and part of that is demographics. Part of that is, I'm looking around the room, right? We have people who have retired. So we had the baby boomers coming through. They actually had a high rate of, for that demographic, for the age group, they had a high rate of participation in the labor force coming out of the recession. So people, there were people who took a hit to their retirement savings and decided to stay in the labor force for longer. We saw some of that. But, you know, now the puzzle is, why don't we have more people participating in the labor force on the younger side? So some of that is job market wasn't great and people went to graduate school and, you know, stayed out of the labor force for a little bit. That's all kind of shaking out. And there are doctoral dissertations, I'm sure, being written on, you know, really looking and slicing and dicing the labor force participation. So that's one measure that comes out of this report as well. So another piece of information that we're always very interested in, because it's one thing to have job growth, but if wages aren't growing, then you know, people wonder about the quality of that job growth and if people are really better off, even though they're getting a job. So fortunately, we're starting to see some growth. Average hourly earnings, which comes out of that monthly labor report, grew 2.5% year over year. And you can see this trend. It's a very uninteresting chart, right? Because the trend has been in this narrow band around 2% growth in hourly earnings for all, you know, pretty much all of the recovery. And just those starting to pick up. So, you know, I'm feeling a little every month that this data comes out and we see it start keep continuing to trend upward. I think that's encouraging. So now 2.5% is a good sign. And I wouldn't be a good Federal Reserve economist if I didn't talk about inflation. And you know, the Federal Reserve, we have a dual mandate, and that is maximum employment, and which doesn't mean ever-growing employment. It means maximum given the constraints of population size and productivity and all of that, and low and stable inflation. So this is the most familiar of the inflation measures, and that's the consumer price index. It's used a lot for escalation clauses. If you have rental property, you might use it to tie increases in rent. So we see two pieces of this here, two pieces. The overall consumer price index, which is all items, and core CPI. I want to point out that the key is wrong. I apologize for that. I didn't catch it in time. But for all items, 0.7% growth. That's the lighter blue line that you see kind of dipping down and hovering around zero. And core CPI strips out food and energy. It strips them out because, excludes them, because they're very volatile. So, and you can see that in the, how much more volatile that all items line is compared to the core. So because those things, energy and food, tend to move up and down and more dramatically, in order to get some sense of longer term where we're going, we look at the core CPI. So that's been growing at 2.1% when we exclude food and energy. So again, energy prices have really brought that consumer price index down. But it has started to go back up, even that core number. And here, the core PCE index, personal consumption expenditure index, is just another measure of inflation, and it's one that the Federal Open Market Committee uses as its longer run target. It's related to this measure, and this is the core PCE price index. So again, stripping out food and energy, and it grew at 1.4% in the fourth quarter of 2015, year over year, and those. The other thing I'm showing you here is the staff projections for core PCE. And you might imagine that there's a wider range. You can tell that that's showing the central tendency, those bars that are going out there. So that's showing you the range of the estimates. Well, it's harder to predict when are energy prices going to go back up. You know, what effect is that going to have here? There's a range there, but longer term, when you go out to 2019, you see that converging on 2%. That's because the Federal Open Market Committee has a goal of 2%, and monetary policy has a pretty good record of targeting inflation. So longer term, that's the goal, 2%, and you see it right there. So this is a little bit, I'm not going to read to you the Federal Open Market Committee statement. At the FOMC issues a statement, and I know in the back you can't read this, but I just wanted to describe a little bit of what it contains, because every eight times a year, after every FOMC meeting, this statement is released, and it has some components to it that it covers the same components each time, I should say. So here, it always starts out by describing the state of the economy. And so in this statement, January 27th, 2016, the FOMC described labor market conditions as having improved further, even as economic growth had slowed late in the year. So fourth quarter GDP we now know was pretty slow, yet we still had decent job gains. Household spending and business investment were increasing at a moderate pace. Here we acknowledge that net exports had softened and inventory accumulation was softer. So this is overall the assessment of the economy. And it always starts with this summing up of economic conditions. And then it moves on to kind of reiterate the mandate of the FOMC, which, as I said, is maximum employment and price stability, and what the committee expects that the economy will be doing. So the committee expects economic activity will expand at a moderate pace, and labor market conditions will continue to strengthen. So there's a little bit of a forward-looking component to this. If there are any kind of risks to that outlook, those are stated as well. So here there's the acknowledgement that inflation is expected to remain low because in the near term because of energy prices declining, but that we expect that inflation will go back up towards 2% as those energy prices kind of start to come back up. And that the committee is closely monitoring economic and financial developments to assess their risks to the outlook. So there's this restatement of the mandate and then what the committee sees going forward. And then there's, of course, the decision. So based on that outlook, the committee decided to maintain the target range for the federal funds rate at 0.25% to 0.5%. Before December, it was 0% to 0.25%. That's why I just described it as near zero before. So it just went up a little bit. But that the stance of monetary policy remains accommodative. It remains basically an easy money environment. So that federal funds rate, as I mentioned, impacts other short-term rates in the economy and through that longer-term rates as well. The committee mentions here that they expect that there will only need to be gradual increases in the federal funds rate. And then very importantly, it comes back to that last statement at the end, that the actual path of the federal funds rate will depend on the economic outlook as informed by incoming data. The incoming data is a really important word here that the committee will be just continuing to monitor. And there was, for a time, we had what was called forward guidance that was stating a particular date when they where we were expecting to keep the rate between 0.25% for, you know, through mid-2015. So now it's just strictly based on the incoming data. So to last couple slides, what I wanted to just show is what does that mean that we, even though we're raising that federal funds rate target, that we still have an accommodative stance of monetary policy. And this is showing the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. And these are assets held by the Federal Reserve. And when you see this strong growth in what the Federal Reserve is holding in terms of assets, you can think of a flip side to this of being reserves that are being held by banks. So banks have significant amounts of reserves that have grown over time. And the Federal Reserve had various programs of bond purchasing. You may have heard QE1, QE2 is quantitative easing, is what the overall program was referred to by in the popular media anyway. And so you see that it has risen to a high level and it has stayed there. So the accommodative policy that is still in place is that this balance sheet is still quite big. And what the Federal Reserve has been doing is reinvesting principal payments from our holdings of mortgage-backed securities, agency debt, and rolling over our treasuries. You see we have a treasury portfolio. The dark line is our holdings of U.S. government treasuries, which has been our traditional instrument to purchase and sell government treasuries in order to influence the supply of money. That is high, and again, we're holding that at a steady level. So because of those actions to kind of keep that balance sheet on large, that's the accommodative nature of policy that's still in place, even though interest rates are going up just a little bit. And the statement that the FOMC has made is that this balance sheet will continue to stay large like this until the federal funds rate is well underway in terms of becoming more normalized, getting to a higher rate over time. So until that's well underway, we can expect that this is just going to kind of stay in place the way it is. And this is just another snapshot of the growth over different periods of time, starting back to when the recession started and we were primarily holding Treasury securities, to the world we're in now, which is a different world for the Fed, where we hold a lot of mortgage-backed securities, as an example, and miscellaneous other, you know, mainly it's larger, much larger holding of Treasuries and all these agency mortgage-backed securities that we hold. And finally, I can't give you a crystal ball about, or can't look into my crystal ball to tell you where interest rates will go exactly and when. As we saw in the statement, it's dependent on the inflow of economic data. But as part of the projections, same as the real GDP projections that you saw, as well as the inflation projections, the governors and the presidents submit where they think the federal funds rate target will be over time. And this is what we see. So by the end of 2016, it looks like somewhere between you could think of the concentration of estimates is at somewhere between 1.25 and 1.5. There's, you know, quite a bit of dispersion around in these estimates as we go further out until you get to the longer run. And in the longer run, it looks like 3.25 to 3.5 is where the committee is converging. So 2019 and beyond. But this is produced four times a year, every time the staff projections, summary of economic projections, is submitted. You get this, what we lovingly refer to as the dot chart, with all their interest rate projections. So that was sort of the tour of a little bit of the national economy and monetary policy. And then this is just kind of summarizing some of the points we made about what's going on in Virginia and in Charlottesville, where we've had, especially in Charlottesville, we saw, you know, the job growth recovery had been stronger, and now the rate of growth is softer. But, you know, keep in mind that picture where we've actually recovered more jobs in the Charlottesville MSA than we have in the state relative to where we started, going back to the beginning of the recession. Home price growth kind of fluctuates somewhat more in the region, but again, on pace with Virginia's growth. And the U.S. economy, we've kind of gone through this range of measures, looking at the moderate pace of growth in real GDP, decent labor market indicators, housing market moving slowly but improving. And inflation is still below where the FOMC would like to see it, at that 2% target for their longer run objective. But again, these lower energy prices and non-energy import prices are having an impact on prices here in the U.S. So with that, I'll stop talking and take some questions.
Thank you very much, Anne. We are now into our usual question and answer session. We are podcast, so if you will raise your hand, and I see one question over there, you will be given a microphone so that you can be recorded. And please, just as a courtesy, say your name so that Anne knows who she's addressing. So go ahead.
Thank you very much for your talk. My name is Kim Swanson, and my question has to do with Freddie Mac still being under government conservatorship. If the Federal Reserve is holding the mortgage-backed securities of Freddie Mac, or how does that tie in?
Yes. So the agency mortgage-backed securities are Freddie Fannie. Yes. So how does that tie into the right? Yes, that is what we're holding. Right.
And Herod, how does the Department of Labor identify the numbers to which you refer as the base on which the participating labor force is calculated? You refer to the documentation of participating labor force, correct?
Right.
So how do you figure out who is the base on which you figure out who are the participants?
Right. So the Department of Labor, part of that is survey-based. I guess I should say all of it is survey-based. But, you know, so there are population estimates that go into that, because the labor force participation rate, and I probably should have defined it a little better. So it's the number of people who are participating in the labor force as a share of the population that is eligible to be in the labor force, right? So, right. Right, so it's 16 and above is the age. So there's no cutoff on the higher end, because you can keep working. There's no cutoff of, you know, 64 people stop working, or 67. So, but it's 16 is generally working age population. So 16 and above, it's that measure of the population. So, you know, those population based estimates are more census than Department of Labor, but the labor force estimates are Department of Labor, and that's survey based information.
Dick Kupsel, there's been some discussion the last couple of months of negative interest rates through the banks. I believe it's mostly in Europe at this point.
I think Japan
Okay.
And
Portugal and a couple of other places. Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate, or does the Fed anticipate this perhaps coming across the pond to us?
So that is a good question. I'm not purview to all of the, you know, what might be under consideration, but that's not something I have heard anything about that would be under consideration here. I mean, we've had a lot of other tools that the Fed has been using, you know, during the crisis and following the crisis. And so specifically, I can't really answer that. It's not something I've heard about, though. So the fact that I haven't really heard about it here, that could be telling. Yeah.
In the back.
My name is John Martin. Based upon all the data that you presented and the analyses, can you tell whether, particularly the data pertaining to the Charlottesville area, can you tell from that data whether local government is doing anything wrong? Is there anything there that suggests that we are doing something wrong?
John, don't ask me a loaded question. I don't think I could read that from the data. I mean, I don't think that that's something that I would necessarily have the expertise to comment on. And I don't think you can draw that conclusion from the data that we saw, to be honest. So, there are a lot of factors at play when you're looking at economic growth.
Good afternoon, Ann. Thank you very much for the presentation. I have a question on, you talked about core CPI, excluding food and energy, and core PPE. And right now it's to our advantage if our rates are and our salaries are increased by the core, because it's higher, core is higher than the CPI and the PPE. But there are times when it's just the opposite, you know, where you find that the core is more stable and lower than the others. Mm-hmm. But I guess my question is, given that the Federal Reserve uses the core primarily, is there any consideration of using a broader-based consumer price index when it is higher than the core, as far as the impact on the ability to keep up with expenditures, since we have to pay for everything?
Right. So let me go back to the chart for a second. Just, it might be helpful to look at that. So there, that shows them all. That's for the consumer price index. And so, I mean, one thing I want to point out here is that you can see that the all items CPI, consumer price index, it moves over the period of a year. It can be above, and then the year later it can be below. And so whereas we have much more steady core CPI growth. And so one of the things to point out is that, you know, monetary policy, so an increase in the interest rate or a reduction in the interest rate, if that's the environment we're in, its effect on the economy takes place with some lag, right? So, to react to inflation that seems higher than target or seems lower than target, and it's this transitory 1 year, maybe even a 6 month thing, would kind of lead us sort of, with this movement around or reaction to monetary policy that could get us into trouble because really that trend is going to work itself out. So that's kind of my answer to that, is that's why we don't focus on the more volatile all items piece. But you're right, sometimes it's because energy prices are really high, and we've all had that experience. And then the discussion is more about, you know, how much of a bite is that taking out of consumer spending because you have to pay more at the gas pump. Now the conversation is really the other way. And, consumer spending was kind of soft in the fourth quarter. Holiday spending was not that great. It was below expectations, and some of that was attributed to very mild weather. People weren't buying all the winter clothing that they might otherwise have bought for themselves or as gifts. And so, you know, even though you had more money in your pocket because you weren't paying as much as at the pump or not paying as much for your fuel bill for your home, you know, we had other factors that come into play. But so anyway, I hope that answered your question a little bit.
My name is Dave, and could you go forward to the reserve that we have right there? And one of the things I'd like to see, by the way, is the dots from 2005, when somebody made the dots in 2005, what they expected it to be. I would presume it would be much different than the real world.
I'm not sure we had the dots in 2005.
Okay. But it looks like before 2008, it was just at $1 billion, and all of a sudden now things have changed radically. Well, could you fill me in as mm-hmm. to why that is?
Right. So part of that was the size of the crisis that we were reacting to. So you can see we had some. I put this short-term lending to financial firms. Those were short-lived programs, but those were directly helping out financial institutions that were large and could have had a dramatic impact on the economy, AIG as an example. Okay, so that's that purple in there. So those were some things that kind of contributed to the spike up. But the largest piece of it was when the Fed started that operations focused on broader credit conditions. That's the purchasing of the mortgage-backed securities that the Fed started to do because the housing market was not recovering. You know, it was a financial crisis and housing-related financial crisis. And so that sector got... that was one of the ways that we reacted was by purchasing both those securities as well as more treasury securities. And so what happened was that once we took interest rates to zero or near zero, we had to turn to another tool to try to stimulate economic growth. And that tool was the purchases of these assets. So it's not normal. We don't, if you look back, you would see the trend would look a lot like what you're seeing there in 2007. And if we took that back, it would look a lot like that with our purchases, you know, just for the normal carrying out of monetary policy being much smaller purchases and sales of our treasury portfolio. But because interest rates were at zero, then we couldn't use the federal funds rate target tool anymore because although the question we had here about negative interest rates, that's one thing that countries can do if they've tried some of these other things and they're not working. So, you know, we have so far in the U.S. with our purchases of securities, we have been able to get some growth going that other countries would be happy to have the rates of growth that we have seen here. You know, so that's it basically was that the interest rate target was already zero. We had to turn to some other measures.
Brian Thomas, I'm going to follow up on a question asked earlier about the unemployment rate.
Yes.
From numerous articles I've read, the unemployment rate shown at 4.9, but may truly be higher given the people that have actually given up looking for full-time employment. Do you have any statistics on that?
Yes, there are statistics on that. They're called alternative measures of labor utilization that are produced by the Department of Labor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And there's one that's called U6 that people generally refer to when they talk about underemployment, which is, I think, kind of some of what you're getting at. It includes people who are marginally attached to the workforce, which means that they really would like to have a job. They're not officially counted in the labor force because they haven't looked in the past 4 weeks. They've kind of given up looking, but they really want to work. And it also includes people who are, it's called part-time for economic reasons, which sounds strange, but you can think of it as part-time, but would prefer to be working full-time. That rate, if you take those things into account, then, and you count those people both as unemployed and as being in the labor force, then you get an unemployment rate that most recently was at 9.9%. It was much higher, 17-18% during the recession, and it has come down significantly. So it has, if you looked at that trend, it has come down as the official unemployment rate that's now 4.9%, as it has come down, so has that number. So it's coming down, but it's still elevated. So whereas we've got now the official unemployment rate that's 4.9%, that's, you know, compares favorably to previous recoveries. That U6 rate that includes some of those other measures, it's a little bit higher than what we've seen in the past. So it's still high.
And Bob McGrath, help me please to finally understand, looking at that balance sheet, you talk about purchasing mortgage-backed securities and so forth. What are the assets used to purchase? Where does the Fed get the money?
Okay. So I mentioned that you see that we can create as my, so that we actually purchase those mortgage-backed securities, and where it shows up is in the reserve balances that we see. If I were to show, this is showing our assets, and if I were to show our liabilities, so, you know, currency is a liability for us, those are but also bank reserves are a liability. So the banks hold reserves with the Fed, and so the counterbalance is that you see this growth in reserves on the part of banks, because when we pay someone for those mortgage-backed securities, that money is in the system and it shows up in reserve bank balances with the Fed. So it's that's the counterbalance part of it. Don't say that.
Then what happens?
So, you know, the Federal Reserve, we may very well take a loss on some of those assets when we go to sell those assets. So that's something that's as real for the Federal Reserve as it would be for a private entity holding those same assets.
But yeah. The whole point, I thought, was to get those reserves back in the hands of the banks so that they would go out and lend money.
Right. So. Yes.
And that was the last question, but thank you very much. That was delightful.